today we have a panel of economists and a panel of experts, of tax experts and civil society. I'll be chairing the morning session, and my co-chair, the chairperson of the Joint Budget Committee, will be chairing the afternoon session. So today we have two economists appearing before us.
As to the views of society on the budget presented by the minister. We have Ms. Nazmira Mula, economist from Macquarie Securities, and Mr. Jack Lopcha, the group economist for Sosana. Welcome. The first presentation will be made by Ms. Nazmira Mula. Over to you now.
Good morning. Can everyone hear me? Sorry, I'm normally very sad with technology. Thank you all for having me today. I actually prepared a relatively short presentation highlighting what I think are the key issues as the backdrop for the budget and then what my key concerns were coming out of it. So that should leave plenty of time for Q&A. Looking at the budget, just setting the scene, those for me were the three things to look at in terms of what revenue was going to do in 2009. We had growth grinding to a halt late last year. Up until then, the South African economy had been reasonably insulated, enjoying a fairly gentle downswing. We had small catastrophes in terms of electricity in the third quarter. Concerns around mining in the third quarter, but the year-on-year growth rate was still ticking along above 2%. In the fourth quarter, growth completely ground to halt. We had halted data up last week, which showed mining manufacturing contracting by quite a large amount in December. What happened is as miners and manufacturers saw demand tailing off from their customers across the world, they just extended their December holidays. So production numbers for December looked very weak, and they're probably going to be the same for January. And as a result of this, what we expect to see is government revenues being a fair bit lower than they were previously projected. Not an actual decline between what they raised this year and what they're going to raise next year, but a fair bit weaker than they've previously been looking for. So if you just look at the growth outlook, this graph with lots of little bars all over it. Essentially what it is annual growth on page 4 for each of the sectors starting in 2006 all the way through to our forecast for 2009. And what you see, first of all, is the sectors that grew the strongest in the last couple of years, construction, not a surprise. Everywhere you go you see new buildings going up, new housing, new shopping centres. But beyond that, other areas where the green bars are still being pretty solid, transport and communications, so everything to do with telecommunications and transportation, financial services, surprisingly strong, and also government. So the government spending held up quite well through last year. Agriculture at the beginning, I neglected to mention a little bit, partially because it's a relatively small portion of GDP, but you saw very strong growth there last year. So what do we expect to happen into 2009? I think our forecasts are on the more optimistic end. We've got 1.6% growth forecast for 2009. Treasury came up with a number of 1.2% last week, and I've seen forecasts as low as 0.4%. Even if you take a 0.4% GDP growth forecast for 2009, if we manage to keep growth positive, South Africa will record some of the strongest growth across emerging markets. We've got some reports I've seen recently coming out of Brazil, -2%, -3% this year. It's actually extreme. The consensus is a bit better, but there are deep growth concerns across the world. The most optimistic numbers in terms of magnitude, not surprisingly, China, consensus seems to be about 6%. But the fear is that Chinese growth could look more like 4 or 5. Given what's happening in the developed world, if Chinese growth is much below 6, it would mean net it would mean something pretty transformative for us in Warren Hall. Why does China matter so much for us? Well, it's actually the second set of bars on the graph of mine. The single biggest driver of demand for commodities, all the stuff we get out of the ground, is China. And we all know we're not going to see much pickup in demand from the US or Europe. So the key question is, does Chinese construction activity recover as the year progresses? That's what we saw happen last year. Last year, we were all so focused on the fact the US was slowing, and what this was going to do was cause a slowdown in exports from China. And then as Chinese exports slowed, it would back up into the rest of the economy. And actually, that's not what happened at all. Chinese export growth remained in double digits until October last year. October 2008, Chinese export growth was still growing at 17%. What we all ignored, Macquarie was very much one of those, we ignored the fact that construction activity started slowing in March. And we wrote it down to bad leads and lags, and maybe it's just one or two cities, maybe it's because of the Olympics, and the government trying to slow down activity so that everything was beautiful for the Olympics. We made all sorts of excuses, it was all nonsense. What had happened was in late 2007, Chinese government decided the economy was overheating, and they then enacted a number of measures, a lot of them regulatory and bureaucratic, in order to slow down the economy. What this did is you immediately started to see the A-share markets fall in China, as households got worried about what was going to happen to the economy. They took their savings and started putting it into banks out of the share market. The next thing that happened about 3 months later is property transactions slowed down. And by the time we got to May last year, construction activity was decelerating sharply, which meant demand for iron ore, steel, ferrochrome, a whole range of things we produce, started to fall very sharply by the time we got into June and July. So the question now is, the reason why I spent so much time telling you about China. The key question for South African growth this year is the Chinese authorities are aggressively trying to get their construction sector going. You've seen a huge loosening in credit conditions, and you've started to see bank lending pick up very aggressively. If that translates into a pickup in construction activity over the course of the next couple of months, that will be positive for commodity prices as you get towards the third quarter of this year, and which means South African growth somewhere in the order of 1.5% is possible. That's what our forecast is pointing to. If China doesn't manage to get construction growth, actually something sub 1%, 0.5%, very positive is what we're going to be looking at. So unfortunately, as much as we can try and use fiscal and monetary policy to counter the effects of the slowdown, we have very little control. Looking at what our trade numbers look like on page 5, it's just a simple analysis there of exports. So what we've done is we've taken total dollar earnings for a range of our most important exports. Last year totaled about $50 billion. And looking at what we expect for 2009, so it's a decline of roughly $14 billion, which equates to about 25% decline in dollar earnings for exports. This is why China matters. And even with our price forecast, if they worsen that, the export number will be even weaker. Just before I go on to some of the actual budgetary issues, we've now looked at a lot of the external issues. One of the things that key for what monetary policy looks like is the inflation outlook. It's difficult to provide a complete forecast right now because we've got technical changes from Stats.sa changing from a CPI headline, and headline's not going to include interest rates anymore, but only the quick rent. you know, this is what we think inflation is going to look like. It might be a little bit too optimistic in the first half of this year. We're pretty much going into the target range quite aggressively. So the last component, I think, before we look at revenue, is the point. Inflation is coming down, the Reserve Bank has cut interest rates. What's employment going to look like? Lots of numbers on page 7. The bottom line is we expect about 270,000 jobs to be lost this year. A lot of those jobs will be in manufacturing, retail, and financial services. Remember, financial services also include real estate. So a lot of people that were employed as estate agents or anything to do with that sector find the process of losing jobs. The mining sector, between late last year and this year, we've got employment down 70,000 to 80,000, which is actually quite amazing. From the 2007 number that Stats and Fed published for mining, we're taking 20% off the workforce. A lot of that will be contracted. A lot of that won't make the headlines because a lot of what the mines use as their labor force are contracting services. So one of the reasons we've seen construction companies' share prices hit so hard in the JSC is both of them have mining services businesses that supply contractors into mining. Both Avenge and Marion Roberts do that. And that was one of the first phases of mine started cutting back. So about 2.2% decline in employment this year. You put it all together, weaker growth, and you look at what the revenue numbers the government's looking for. They're looking for a 5.2% increase in revenue between the fiscal year ended March next year and the one that will end in March this year. 5.2% in nominal terms will be the slowest growth rate since the 70s. In real terms, it's the slowest growth rate since 1993. Pretty close to the growth rate we saw in 2000-2001, but pretty much in actual magnitude, the slowest real growth rate in revenue since 1993. So in terms of overall magnitude, we think the government's being relatively conservative in terms of what they expect from revenue, which makes sense. I think that's a very good thing at this stage. The last thing you want is aggressive revenue forecasts, which you then in 6 months' time have to go back to departments and say, oh, so sorry, we need to take that money back from you. Because there is a risk of that. The risk of growth forecasts is that they're going to end up being revised lower over the course of this year. The risk is revenue is going to end up being lower as well. The one area that we are a little bit concerned, if you look at total tax revenue, this is from the budget review. So just over 5% growth this year, total tax revenue. The one area which perhaps is a little bit too optimistic is company taxes. We've got a 1% decline in company taxes between last year and this year. The mining sector accounts for 20% of corporate taxes. Mining profits are going to halve between last year and this year, and in some companies will be even larger. When I sit down with my mining analyst and he tells me that if current prices of commodities persist for a year and a half, Anglo-American could have funding problems, chances are they're not going to be paying much in the way of taxes. So, on revenue, what I've summed it up as, I think forecasts are, as an aggregate, are relatively conservative at 5%. However, corporate taxes could end up being lower than forecast. So there's downside risk. What is money being spent on? We saw some increases in terms of social programs, but there's also quite a big increase in terms of infrastructure spending. A lot of that's not coming out of central government budget, though, it's coming out of parastatal budgets. But the chart on page 10 has the increase in infrastructure spending over the course of the years. So the government's now looking for $797 billion to be spent on infrastructure over the next 3 years, up from $693 billion in the previous forecast in last October. That extra $105 billion spread over 3 years equates to an extra 1.2% of GDP per annum. If you have to pick the type of spending that would be most beneficial to lower income groups in South Africa on a sustainable basis, so it's not let's just increase grants for this year. On a sustainable basis, what would be most beneficial? In many ways, it's infrastructure spending, because it creates jobs as well. Tax cuts benefit your middle class as well. Infrastructure spending will create jobs on a large scale. And at the same time, what infrastructure spending does that grants will never do is it increases the long-term competitiveness of the country. So it means the spending can pay for itself several years down the line. It's not money that's going to be hands up, thank you very much, and next month I need some more fees. Sorry, the title of page 11 is a bit fudged into our banner, but it reads, what happens in budget deficits? 3.8% budget deficits in 2009. So what this graph has is the blue bars are the forecasts for the deficit that the Treasury had in October, and the red bars are the new forecasts. So quite a dramatic increase in budget deficit forecasts. The main reason for it is declining revenue. Commitments to keep spending pretty much in line with previous forecasts, but there's decrease in revenue. The place where you actually saw the biggest increase in your spending was the tariff savings. So the graph on page 12 is exactly the same as the previous one, but this is the total public sector. And it looks pretty similar in many ways. Blue bars were a lot lower than the red bars are going to be. It's important to remember though the magnitudes are different. So the previous graph on page 11, we're looking at minus 3.8% in 2009. Page 12, minus 7.5% of GDP. Which is pretty aggressive. This is a very stimulatory budget when you take into account what the public sector as a whole is going to have to borrow out of financial markets this year. 7.5% of GDP equates to roughly $167 billion. Actually, unlike total borrowing requirements, $181 billion. After we estimate at least $110 billion is going to be taken out of the local bond market, unless the government manages to find further loans from the World Bank or thereabouts. That is quite optimistic. At this stage, I think borrowing much more than about $80 billion out of the local bond market is going to be difficult, which means there's upward pressure on bond yields as we move through this year. I can see why it's been done. I think it's necessary. I think governments around the world are doing it. And I'm not saying it shouldn't be done. I'm just saying they can't. And sum up where I do this. I think the point I've made, growth forecasts are vulnerable, which means revenue forecasts could be a bit weaker. Having said that, I think the Treasury's worked hard to produce a budget that's relatively stimulatory while not being detrimental to the country on a five-year view. We're not in the situation the US is in where you're almost scrambling to keep the banking system and the economy afloat. Or you could face the Great Depression. We don't have those issues. We've got a sound banking system. So we don't need those knee-jerk reactions. Also, to be honest, it can't afford it. US Treasury issuing 12-15% of GDP this year, which increasing certainly looks like what they're going to end up doing, is possible because you have a large domestic investor base who are so terrified to put their money anywhere else with the name of the US Treasury. South Africa, we don't have the same room because who's going to buy a bond? This is much more than they currently forecast. And that's my presentation. So I think we'll leave it for questions now.
Thank you so much. It was quite possible. Question. Mr. Mbuni, Mr. George, Mr. Marais, Mr. Mporto, and that's all. Thank you.
In the wake of a declining revenue and increasing public debt, or increasing public borrowing, increasing public debt, increasing public borrowing. Do you think the minister was justified to keep corporate tax minimum this year? Because then you look at it, corporate tax is actually not really increased. More or less, it's the same. Now, do you think it was the minister justified to keep corporate tax at least this year? And secondly, my third question is that the minister has given the mining sector 1.8 billion tax relief in the form of not imposing the royalty tax this year. The objective of which is to save jobs. Do you think that 1.8 billion will really play a role in reducing retrenchment in the mining sector? Taking into consideration that most of the people are employed in the platinum mines and the gold mines. The rest of you are in surely other base metals, like iron ore, manganese, etc. And then my last question is on the issue of the existing exchange control regulations. As business, as economists, you think that South Africa needs to get rid of all the remaining exchange control regulations. Now, in the wake of this financial crisis, are you still advocating for such removal of exchange control regulations?
Can I just ask the corporate taxes?
Questions first. Okay. Sorry. Okay. Dr. George.
Thank you, Jim. Thanks, Ms. Muller, for a very interesting yet scary presentation. It seems that the banks are very reluctant to lend for property transactions at the moment. Is there anything that government can do to keep this market alive under the conditions that we're in at the moment? And then the second question is obviously government is implementing counter-cyclical fiscal policy, which we support. So government is attempting to spend its way out of the crisis in a way. But my question is that possible, one? And secondly, there is a lot of stimulus focused on government intervention. But is there not space for stimulating business and entrepreneurs who, certainly in my view, are key drivers to moving this economy forward in a time like this? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. You've certainly painted a very bleak picture for us, but that's a reality, so it's absolutely necessary. For an economy to grow again in the future, we obviously need people to be employed. You have given us indication that we'll probably lose 270,000 jobs. You have said that the infrastructure spending seems to be the only positive point that you have picked up. But infrastructure, isn't that probably because we have been lacking behind maintenance on infrastructure and you know, in terms of 2010 as well? And then will this infrastructure spending, the importance of that, will that sector be able to absorb not only what we have lost, but in terms of increased jobs as well? Then secondly, again on job creation, are your opinion that the budget has addressed the concerns of job creation effectively, and maybe to take what my colleague has said about entrepreneurship further, SMMEs we know is really what can create jobs, whether enough has been done on that, and whether you've got any comments on that part of the budget. Thank you.
Yes, no good.
Good morning. I just want to ask two questions first. With regard to the statement made, especially on Brazil, that it might manage a higher growth, higher than normal growth as compared to other economies. I just want to get rather to what is it that Brazil is doing to incentivize that growth, and whether business is playing its part in terms of doing that. The next question would be, like you have gone into detail with the issue of growth deficit, are there alternatives that government has in order to deal with the scenario that you have projected? Thank you.
No further questions. Okay, over to you, ma'am.
One quick question from my side of clarification on the first question on corporate taxes. Was the proposal that, given the deficit, we should have raised the corporate tax rate, or is the question, given that businesses are suffering, we should lower the corporate tax rate? Sorry, just so that I know exactly where we are.
I think comparatively speaking, as compared to last year, on the 2008-2007, corporate tax is relatively low this year, but there has been much increase in corporate tax. Now, in the wake of that, you think it is justifiable that in the wake of the increasing budget deficit, was it wise really to not to keep the tax as is, or not to impose some more taxes on corporate?
Thank you very much for the support. Okay, let me try and get through all of this. In terms of corporate taxes, I mean, the reason for the decline is the fact that profits are contracting. It's not a case of businesses don't want to pay more, it's a question of they don't have the money to pay. I actually think the worst thing we could have done in this environment is try and raise corporate taxes, because that would have just exacerbated the job loss. You know, companies are facing shrinking profits, they're trying to control their margins, which is why we, in the process of seeing people being laid off, you increase the tax rate and you just exacerbate the problem. So my answer would be, I would suspect not. My point in terms of corporate taxes, I think you're actually going to see further shrinkage than what's already been forecast. So I think profits are going to be weaker than we expected, which is got nothing, as I said, nothing to do with how much businesses want to get to the making this money. The mining sector in particular sees property slash very, very dramatic. The next issue in terms of the mining sector and the royalties of 1.8 billion rand, to be perfectly honest, I think the far, let me clarify. I haven't looked at this in great detail. Our mining analyst has, and his opinion is the biggest impact on jobs that this extension of the period before which companies start paying mining royalties will have is that companies may not retrench people due to political pressure. In terms of actual benefits to companies, he thinks the companies that will benefit most are the ones that would already have made quite reasonable profits this year. So the gold companies, the coal companies, he thinks will be the two biggest beneficiaries. And their profits were actually going to be reasonably solid this year. The areas in which you actually do face far greater pressure are things like platinum, where he doesn't see the bulk of this 1.8 billion rand actually going into. So there should be some benefit at the margin, but it won't be because the companies that need to retrench are getting a whole lot extra from the tax. It will be because of the political pressure. That's our analysis. In terms of exchange control regulations, I actually haven't been a very loud voice in saying that exchange control should be abolished. And actually, when the financial crisis started, I've written several articles saying, thank goodness we had exchange control, because you saw our banks being relatively protected by that. We have a banking system that's very well capitalized, very little involvement in any of the larvae debt that was sold out of the US. And it's not, much as I'm sure they'd like to believe, it's not because our bank managers are that much smarter than the head of Barclays or Morgan Stanley or Citibank was. It's simply a case of they want a large to buy it. So I think you need some sort of prudential regulations around that capital basis in terms of how companies can borrow and invest. Does that mean exchange control should remain as they are? Probably not. I think in some ways there are regulatory burdens in there that are unnecessary. But does that mean there should be some regulations around the whole thing? Of course. I think complete abolition doesn't make sense. If that answers your question. Moving on to the gentleman over there. The question was, banks are reluctant to lend into the property market, and what can governments do? Can governments do anything? I think it's quite difficult, short of directed lending, for governments to do a whole lot. We've seen the Australian government make some interesting moves where they've almost got the banks around the table and said, okay, how much are you prepared to pledge to lend into the housing sector over the next year? Come up with a number of however many $100 billion, and then they're monitoring how this goes. The question for me is there's no penalty for not doing the lending, because there hasn't been any incentive provided ahead of time. It's not like the government said, oh, well, we'll give you tax breaks for doing this. So it's therefore difficult to impose a penalty on the other side if they don't. But as a first step, something like that could certainly be tried. There's still no clear evidence. Australia is the only country that I've seen actually trying to do this, that has an independent banking system. The reason why I say it is the Chinese are obviously the best example of a country that have aggressively made their banks lend, and we've already started to see the benefits of that. But I think we don't have quite the same pressure to apply as the Chinese government does when they could execute their bank management. So short of that, I would start by trying with the Australian government. In terms of counter-cyclical policies, I think the Treasury tried very hard to implement a counter-cyclical policy. I think the fact that they're prepared to publish the numbers on page 12 in terms of public shows exactly that. We go back 2 years, they were looking for the public sector to be in very small deficits over the next 3 to 5 years in the region of 0.5, 1.5% The fact that they're not prepared to publish 7.5% deficits for the public sector is a measure of how aggressively we're working to try and implement carbon deficit policy. Two of the questions from two different members brought up the issue of small businesses. This is not an issue only for the current period. I mean, this is a problem that South Africa has had over many years. Dealing with small businesses and supplying skills into them in terms of basic cash flow management, in terms of supplying credit into them from the bank or from government guaranteed lending, across the whole spectrum, is very useful, very little effective to small businesses. The Treasury tried, and perhaps their measures have actually been some of the best, and that they tried very hard to simplify the regulation for small businesses. We've seen a lot of the payroll taxes, a lot of the VAT filing requirements being removed there. Even in some measures, you saw the DTI in its BBBW code exempting small businesses with turnover up to, I think it's 5 million rand a year from any of the BBBW requirements. They have automatic qualification. All of these are very good measures. Now it's taken, okay, we don't have to wade through a lot of the red tape. The next step is give them access to finance. And that there's been no effective mechanism developed there. And at the contrary, one of the chief reasons small businesses fail is bad cash flow management. Moving on to, and related to your question in terms of job creation for SMEs, there was a really interesting study done by the CDE, I think. Which said something like 60-70% of most new jobs created in South Africa over the course of the last couple of years were small and medium sized enterprises. And this is despite the fact that we provide lots of support to them. So, yes, if we want to focus on job creation for the long term, it is about focusing on skills firms and then getting our SMEs. So I think it's really important. Do I have some new groundbreaking idea on how to do this? No, unfortunately. But I do think it's something that deserves a whole lot more focus. In terms of the infrastructure spending and whether infrastructure spending will actually create jobs and why it's being done, I don't have the graph on this pack, unfortunately, but if you look at the breakout of infrastructure spending over the course of the next couple of years, the World Cup proportion is actually directly quite tiny. It's spending on stadiums thereabouts. There's a lot of World Cup related spending that's been triggered by 2010. I'm getting airports going, car train going, a lot of roads, but that all that stuff doesn't expire next year. And I think part of what the Treasury tried to do with this budget together with all the trade centers is just make that very clear. The spending plan is now being detailed well beyond 2010. So I had this conversation with a lot of foreign investors in London 2 weeks ago, and we still get the question, well, how much is this? I mean, I'll start there, well, our growth remains positive because of all the infrastructure spending. But how much of this is just about the World Cup and it's going to die away? And it's not at all, really. It started about that. And that's what got a lot of the infrastructure spending in South Africa going, but that's no longer the primary driver. And one of the benefits that South Africa has as opposed to a whole lot of other countries that are now announcing infrastructure programs is ours is was announced 2 years ago or 3 years ago. So you're already well down the track. Spending is already starting to flow through in a very significant way. It's not the announcing it now, and spending might come through in 18 months, 2 years, 3 years. In the US, it's just announced a $550 billion program. It's going to take at least a year, probably two, before that money really gets grown. any maintenance, that doesn't mean it doesn't create jobs. If we had roads previously that were not maintained at all, and now we start maintaining, we need guys to do the work. Infrastructure is not going to create enough jobs to offset all of the job losses that are offered. But it is going to help a whole lot of people get skills that would otherwise have been left with virtually no benefits met to earn their own income. And I think that's I think I phrased badly at the beginning because my point in Brazil was not that they were going to grow at a higher rate than us, it's actually that they were going to weaken. And what we've seen over the last couple of years is they have been strong. A lot of that just comes from the fact that they came from quite a weak base in 2003, 2004, but a lot of it comes from fairly sound government policies where you've seen a lot of infrastructure being rolled up. And on the other side, you've seen business come from party set to a huge infrastructure, a huge commodity group. So Brazil is a lot like South Africa, most of what it exports is from commodities. So that's what's driven the growth now. The reason why it's going to be quite weak this year is a flip side effect. Iron ore prices are falling quite dramatically. In terms of growth, what are the alternatives to stimulate the economy? In a broad sense, the two ways government can stimulate the economy is one, spend a whole lot more, cut interest rates a lot. The problem is we need to balance that off between trying to create growth in the next 9 to 12 months and create the growth in a 5-year view. And if you spend too much right now and borrow too much, it means on 2 to 3 year view, your ability to spend diminishes very dramatically. So I think the Treasury is doing as much as they can right now. And beyond that, I think what they should be doing is looking at reducing regulation in other areas. That's a non-monetary means of stimulating small businesses in the private sector.
Actually get what's going on in China. And that's all questions. Okay, thanks a lot. Mr. Mugrini, so that's a follow-up question. And,
it's not a follow-up question, just one more question. On page 4, page 5 of the presentation, you mentioned that the South African economy, the 1.3%, we might achieve if the commodity prices, or if actually China construction industry continues to produce, that China construction industry drops, and then we might actually only achieve 0.5% or less than 1.3% economic growth. Which tells me that you are saying that our economic growth at the moment is linked to Chinese construction industry. And in my view, I think the most economic growth in our country has been truly in the financial services and the manufacturing actually, economic growth has been. How do you reconcile the construction industry and our economic growth? Whereas, according to the statistics that we have, we've got the most economic growth from the services industry.
Joseph?
Thank you, Chair. So just a quick comment here. I wasn't sure whether I was listening properly when I hear to Dr. George from the opposition talking about government intervention in the property market. I wasn't too sure whether I was listening properly. Typically, your DA would really wish to take government away from any industry or business, be that as it may. So we might wish to go back to some of the basics that you are taught as you grow politically. One of those relates to the fact that when you are in business, you maximize profits as much as you can. That's the fundamental tenet of any capitalist system, wherever in the world. Now, ours is a mixed economy, wherein we have a mixture of the state intervention with some of the parastatals, and also allowing the private business to pursue and mushroom. Creating that environment as government, which is our role basically, wherein, you know, especially the private sector must flourish. Now, a question that we raised with the minister, which I did not get much clarity, again, it has been raised by Mr. Mbuni here, Congress, Aaron, around the 1.8 royalties that are now being postponed to 2010-2011. The question for me there was, what then do workers have as benefits? Apart from the fact that they are not going to, well, there is going to be little retrenchment for them. But again, it does not give any guarantees that the workers will still retain their jobs. That's about all that you are having for workers. On the other hand, you are saying it yourself, Ms. Muller, that profits are being really squeezed in the process, given all the slowdown that we have in the economy. Fundamental point there is, you have an economy that, I mean, you have a business that continues to make profits, whether small or big. But you have, on the other hand, workers who literally get their situations and conditions. The other person I was talking to just now was telling me in Pretoria, in the automobile industry, they are going on a short time, effectively from this coming Friday. Now, you have there workers literally losing more and more. Now, I would really wish you comment on that. The last one, Chair, that I want to have is on the regulatory framework that our country has, wherein the banks are regulated through Reserve Bank and also other financial institutions through Financial Services Board. I would wish to hear your comment. You did say something, we did allude to that effect, and not necessarily on the specifics, but as we are talking about the regulatory framework. We have that situation in the country. Is that prudent enough for a country and economy of ours like we have to continue with those two regulatory frameworks for the financial institutions that we have in the country?
Let me just pose one or two questions. The question is around the financing of the current account system. What challenges do you think we'd be facing, given that a lot of parastatals will be importing their stuff and will be exporting very little? So how do we balance the two, and what are the risks that we'll be facing, given that a lot of money is going to U.S. Treasury? How then, as South Africa, do we finance that current account deficit? I think that's the first one.
Okay. The first question was about why do I think mining and commodity prices are so important, given that so much of South Africa's growth has come out of construction, financial services, and to a lesser extent, manufacturing in recent years. If you look at actual contribution to GDP, mining is directly only 7% of GDP. However, once you realize that a lot of what happens around the mining sector, financial services supplied into the sector, transport, some of the construction that's related to new mines, the Chamber of Mines estimates that something around 25-28% of the GDP is mining related. So if you have a situation where commodity prices remain largely throughout this year and into next year, large sections of our economy that will be affected by that. The other side of the equation is that in terms of what South Africa exports, something around the order of 65-70% of what we export are either commodities or beneficiaries of commodities, which is why that table on page 5 is actually so important. There's nothing else we export in any real size. There's some motor manufacturers export into the US, but that's also suffering. So the only way that our exports actually remain ahead of imports this year, well, growth remains ahead of imports, not setting up the total, is if you actually see commodity prices starting to improve short term. That's why I think it's kind of important. Is that okay?
Yeah, it does because of other locations, but like how does, you know, China, like India, take our control?
Okay, let's be mindful of time, but okay. If you have other presenters.
Okay, sorry, I'm... But that's why. So commodities are important. The only source of demand, positive demand supply, I see the commodities in the world is Chinese consumption. It's not going to come out of anywhere else in the world. That's why I think it matters. Moving on to the royalty side and this idea of businesses continue to make profits and what happens to workers. I think one of the important things to realize this year is a lot of businesses are not going to make profits, which is unusual in South Africa's history for the last 15 years, because the mining sector, even when commodity prices fell quite dramatically in 1998, had such a massive amount of currency weakness that profits were still marginally positive across the board. And I think the point is that platinum sector, Anglo-American platinum, is going to struggle with this. And you're going to see a lot of mines actually losing money this year. The automotive sector, which you referred to, the most efficient auto manufacturing company in the world, Toyota, and they recently announced that they're looking for $5 billion loss in the coming fiscal year. 2009 is about businesses losing money. 2009 is about businesses losing money. So it's not as simple as saying actually there's some profit. Why are companies doing this for workers? There are a lot of companies that are going to struggle to survive. And it's something that we haven't seen in the past. And that's why I think it's important. In terms of the royalty bill itself, as I said, I don't know if that actually solves the problem, because the commodities where you see the biggest risk to job losses aren't the ones that are going to benefit most from the delay in the royalty bill. Beyond that, in terms of what government can do, in order to help people losing their jobs, it's not that easy. A lot of this skill training would help. The fact that you've got an unemployment insurance fund, which is in the surplus at the moment, also helps. But it's not easy for government. Moving on to banking regulations, I'm not sure I completely understood the thrust of the question, but if it was simply a case of are our banking regulations sufficient at this point in time, I think in general they're actually quite good. And the National Credit Act, which isn't strictly about regulating banks, more about consumers, I think actually helps in that process. At the time that it was implemented in mid-2007, I had a lot of clients, particularly in the US, saying that the government is adhering to national banking system. And I actually think what's going to happen over the course of the next year and a half is we're going to see similar sort of regulations implemented in many developed countries. So there is more that could be done on the banking regulation side, but certainly on a relative basis compared to much of the world, I'm quite comfortable. Last question on the current account deficit. be a challenge. This year, I think that two specific things that are going to help. First of all, in April, you've got the Vodafone purchase of a big chunk of Vodacom. That's going to contribute about 20 billion rand to financing the deficit. The other thing that will also help this year is the World Bank loan that ESCOM is in the process of signing with the bank. That will also go a long way towards financing the deficit. What we expect over the course of the next 12 months is quite a dramatic improvement in the overall deficit. And the reason why is not because of the trade side, as you rightly point out, a lot of parastatals are going to be importing a lot of the components of this program. But if you look at the structure of the current account deficit last year, 35% was trade, so the difference between what we export and what we import. 40 to 45% of it was net dividend outflows. So companies from Old Mutual South Africa were making profits offshore to motor manufacturers who made money from last year, to sell the mine. That's not going to happen this year. So we expect net dividend outflows to decrease very dramatically as these profits are being dramatically cut or actually no profits in some companies. And that's why the overall deficit, by the time we get to the end of this year, fourth quarter, we've got 4.5% of GDP. Fourth quarter last year is going to look more like 7.5%. So the improvements in the deficit, together with a couple of specific deal-related flows, are why we're not that worried about the current account deficit.
Thank you so much, Nian, for your input and the ability to answer our questions. We have to move to the next presenter, Mr. Jack Lotcher.
Jefferson, thank you very much for inviting me to come and talk to you, to give you the opportunity to give you my, as I put it, macroeconomic perspective on the budget of last week. I want to start off with an overall assessment before one gets into bog down into the detail of specific numbers and so on. Firstly, to say I think that the budget was a pragmatic response to a very challenging economic environment, over which South Africa has little, if any, control. Secondly, the taking counter-cyclical fiscal policy, I think, to the next level. In the past couple of years, it was about putting away some of the extra income that we had. This time, it's the opposite. It is dealing with a shortfall in income, but without abandoning fiscal discipline. But I must say the strains are showing, and I'll come back to that a little bit later when I talk about the sustainability of the fiscal position. Thirdly, I think the budget did a fairly good job of balancing the immediate needs, in other words, dealing with the economic downturn that we are experiencing at the moment and that will continue the rest of this year and into next year, with the strategic thrust, in other words, the longer term planning that goes into our fiscal management. Fourth point for me is I think this budget confirms that a budget is not only about putting together a lot of numbers, it's the outcome of government policy in its entirety. And I think it is reflected, for example, in the spending priorities. And lastly, I thought you think that it's very appropriate that in the budget there was a reiteration of the necessity of effective and efficient policy implementation. That it's not only about making money available, but the important thing in the end is what do you do with the money. That will determine what benefits the economy and what benefits the, the people of South Africa in the end will get out of the budget. Now, let me start off with a few comments about the global recession that we're finding ourselves in as a result of the financial crisis that's spilling over into, or has spilled over into an economic crisis. The graph that you see there is from the latest World Economic Outlook update of the International Monetary Fund. It was published only 2 weeks ago, that's very up to date. It shows you that the world economy just about went over a cliff in the fourth quarter of last year, specifically when it comes to the industrial production, manufacturing production side of the economy right across the world. And you can see with that also merchandise export values, how that has declined. The graph shows the percentage change year on year. In other words, the entities are down between 15% and 40% compared to a year ago. I must admit, for me also, myself, that this has been quite a harrowing experience. It's one thing, you know, theorizing about the concept of a credit crunch. It's another thing to see it really happening and the effect that it has in bringing so much economic activity to a virtual standstill. If there's no credit flows, there can be no transactions, including at an international level, and therefore also nothing happens on the production side. There's a big inventory adjustment that needs to take place, and it's suppressing activity. But perhaps just also to say that the short-term effect necessarily is that's the most severe, the adjustment part, but you should get out of that within a matter of months rather than years. And yes, the adjustment, and not the option of growth, of course, but the adjustment. And this just shows you, for us, how do we stack up against what we've seen internationally. This is manufacturing production in South Africa, and you can see if you look there to the right side of the graph, you get a similar picture. We also went over the cliff in the fourth quarter of last year. And if ever there was any doubt whether we are integrated into the global supply chains, I think you see the evidence there that there's no argument anymore about that. At the moment, the way that the IMF is forecasting the economic outlook is depicted there in that graph. You will, of course, get many views and many, many numbers from different forecasters. I'm using the IMF numbers here just as an indication. But you can see there the advanced economies, that red line, going into recession of close to 2%, they said under about 2%. For decline in GDP this year. The emerging world, although remaining in positive territory, also a sharp slowdown, and then of course the blue line shows you the combined result. But as you will see there, the IMF is also looking for a fairly sharp bounce going into next year, starting somewhere in the second half of this year. Now, as I said, these figures are only 2 weeks old, so they're fairly up to date. But already since then, they've made noises about possible revisions, and that if there's going to be revisions, the revisions will be to the downside. I think one must be realistic that the that view of a bounce, that you will see the economy bouncing back, is very dependent on the credit situation, if not normalizing, at least improving meaningfully. And that is. So jury's out on that one, how easy that will be to bring about. So certainly, yes, forecasts are still soft. But then, also having said that, if you look at to the right-hand side of the screen, the level to which they see growth bouncing back, it's not back to the previous level. It's below that still. So somebody has, I think, very aptly described the economic outlook as a square root recovery. We're going to see square root recovery. In other words, if you bounce back, but then sort of you stay on a flat line for some years. I think there's a significant chance of the global economy experiencing below potential growth for a period of 3 years, might even be as long as 5 years. And just to illustrate to you how dependent we are on what happens in the rest of the world. I've just in my graph put together growth in the OECD countries. That accounts for more than 70% of the world economy. And then our own growth. And in general, you can see we follow the same trends. You see accelerating growth trend in the OECD countries. You see an accelerating trend in our growth. And likewise, we're at the moment, there's a deceleration in growth in the OECD countries. There's also a deceleration in our growth. And what it boils down to is, I just want to make the point, it's extremely difficult for us to get high growth independently of the rest of the world. Our economy is just too open to be able to do that. It affects us in a number of ways. Naturally, we're a big commodity exporting country. Ms. Mira has also referred to that and talked about that, but these are the IMF forecasts for a number of commodities in real terms, adjusted for world inflation going into the next year or two. And you can see that they're also in line with the bit of a bounce back in the economy that we see. They think that specifically metals prices, that's important to us, that can come back a little bit. But likewise also the oil price, by perhaps even a bit more than in the case of metals. But food prices, they don't foresee a similar balance in that case. But that's has a negative impact, of course, on our balance of payments, and it has a negative impact on a very important part of our economy, if you look at it from specific industries. The other way in which it impacts on us is the available of capital in the world, capital flows, and for us specifically in terms of financing our current account deficit. Now, the table that you see there, Jay, was produced a few weeks ago by the Institute for International Finance in Washington. They, from time to time, publish these forecasts for capital flows to emerging markets as a universe, as a group. And you can see there, if you look at the net private flows, that's the third line from the top, the 2008 number at $466 billion was already half of what it was in 2007. They see that coming down to $165 billion this year. So that's an enormous reduction in private capital flows to emerging markets as a group. If you look at the line number six from the top, or failure investment, you will see there was a big knock last year, $89 billion outflow. But very importantly for this year, they see only a very small further outflow. And for us in South Africa, that is a crucial number, because we, in the past couple of years, on average, we've depended for about 40% of our capital flows on portfolio inflows. And for me, there is a bit of a light there, visible in the dark, that I think we've had the big knock already. If you look at capital flows in South Africa, I'll show you to just now, the portfolio flows, we took the big knock October last year already. And I don't think we'll get a further big knock going into this year. One of the reasons being, or perhaps the most important reason being, that if you think of the equity market, equity prices are down, if you're looking at it from a perspective of South African. But if you're looking at it from a perspective of an offshore investor, then additionally to that, the fact that the rand has depreciated means for him it's just that much more down. It's actually very cheap. So if you still hold the assets, why do you sell it at these cheap levels? You might rather perhaps look at buying. So as I said, for us, I think that's a little bit of comfort that we can get from that. Where the big swing will come is there on the private creditors. You will see commercial banks net, where last year at $167 billion, that was already substantially down on $410 billion in 2007. But for this year, they see an outflow of about $60 billion, $227 billion turnaround compared to 2008. Now, the fortunate thing once again for us here is that we're not dependent for in our banking system on foreign banks supplying us with funds. Our banks are funded locally. So that's where the big deal is going to take place, but it's going to part with by to a very large extent. So, say if I look at these numbers and then if I add to that the prospect that we will probably go for that $5 to $6 billion loan from the World Bank that's under negotiation at the moment to finance some of ESCOM's expenditure. And if I, on top of that, take into account this new facility that was announced by the IMF, to which we also have access, that puts $14 billion at our disposal. So it must be paid back to the end, but it's available there if we were ready to need it. It tells me that, yes, the current account is a constraint in our economy, but there's a little bit of assurance that we will get by, I think, during the coming year. So this graph shows you, actually, then portfolio flows to South Africa on a net basis. There, that last drop that you see there towards the right-hand side, that was October last year, when people, investors globally, were indiscriminately just selling assets, just getting out of it. But you can see it improved since, and actually, right there on the right-hand side, there's a small uptick, and that's the number up to date for this month. But for this month, actually, so far, it's a little positive number. So perhaps some buying is starting to creep in. And I think to support that, by the way, what's very important is the relative paragraph. If we can then manage to this year, even if we have lower growth, and if we have low growth, but if relatively to others, we doing better, that will attract capital to our shores. As you know, governments to respond to this recessionary conditions globally, across the world, they are applying big fiscal stimulus packages. One difference between us, an important difference between us and many of these countries, is in their case, the monetary policy transmission mechanism is broken down completely because of the credit crunch. It doesn't help lowering interest rates because banks and indicators don't want to borrow, and so you don't really get the benefit. In our case, fortunately, the monetary policy transmission mechanism is still working. So that also perhaps tells you something about the need for fiscal stimulus in our case compared to some other countries that most of the world have been going to recession, that our need is actually a little bit less than theirs. But nevertheless, you can see the balances deteriorating right across the world, although it includes, of course, not only fiscal stimulus in this graph, but also the injections of capital, the bailouts of the banking system, so included there. The table there just summarizes the likely fiscal stimulus this year for the BRIC countries plus the G7, the 11 most important countries in the world then probably. I would like to say we were also on those, but we're just too small. But in any case, you see the percentage of GDP likely fiscal stimulus, and next to that I put in the IMF's latest forecast of growth for this year for that specific country. You can see China at 6% and the bottom there, the United States at 5.8% of GDP. Those are the two countries that are going to be doing the biggest stimulus. But if you look at the rest of them, the average, by the way, the weighted average then is 3.6%. But if you exclude China and the United States, you can see there's one or two countries that get to 2%, but for most it's less than that, compared to, on the other hand, therefore, negative growth. Now, later on, I'll show you the same table, but I'll add South Africa to that to put us into perspective. Now, the downturn locally, of course, we have this global situation to deal with, but I think we must firstly realize that we're already in a downturn. A downturn in the sense at least that the momentum in the economy was slowing down since the second half of 2006 already. Still fairly healthy growth, we're still looking for 3% plus growth for last year, for example, but nevertheless, less than the 5% in the previous couple of years. So there was already a slowdown, and that slowdown was mainly the result of slowdown in household consumption expenditure. The graph showed you the year-on-year growth in retail sales, that's the blue line, and in car sales, the white line there. On top of that now, we've got the additional negative impact of a global crisis that will affect our net exports number negatively. The second leg that was starting to kick in our downturn was private sector investment spending. You can see there's a strong relationship between household consumption spending and private sector investment spending over the years. In other words, if business conditions are improving, if businesses see that their businesses will grow, that demand for their products will grow, they invest more to create new capacity. But if they see growth in demand slowing down, they hold back on their investment, they don't expand capacity, or at least not as rapidly as they otherwise would have done. And as that, as you can see from the blue bars there, we're already in the second leg of that downturn. What this graph tells you, the Reserve Bank's leading indicator, that gives us an idea about a year ahead, what we can expect of the economy. And you can see the leading indicator has been indicated for some time, this sharp slowdown that we see. The leading indicator is down to a level that we've not seen for many, many years. And it shows you that things are still, in terms of the numbers that get released, still have to deteriorate a little bit further before they improve. And it shows you that it will be touch and go whether we have a technical recession or not. I know that the minister said last week we will not have one, we'll escape it. My own personal view is actually I think we are going to have one. But I think we shouldn't get excited about that number. Whether we go at minus 0.1% and have a technical recession, or go at plus 0.1% and avoid a technical recession, that's as far as I'm concerned immaterial. It's still very weak. Still the same impact that we have in the economy. So we shouldn't get hanged up on that. But as I said, the indicator, leading indicator, is showing you that there's some weakness still to go before things will improve. Now, one of the results of that has been that we've already seen a turnaround in the interest rate cycle, of course. That the Reserve Bank has now cut by 150 basis points, with further cuts in the repo rate, basically ensure. In my own commentary last week, or was it the previous week, to the 1 percentage point reduction that we saw in the repo rate, then was to say, I think there must be a good chance that we will have an interim meeting before April with further cut, and then subsequently the governor expressed the same view, and I was quite pleased with that, because I think things on the ground are developing so rapidly. You can't let your policy decisions be dictated to you by a meeting schedule that was decided on last year for a normal kind of year. You should deviate from that if necessary. So I think in March probably we'll get a further 1% reduction, perhaps then another one in April at the official meeting. In total for this year, it's quite, we'll have at least 3 percentage points, but perhaps 4 in the end, depending on how things still pan out. And you should bear this in mind once again, see that in conjunction, we already have the stimulus for the economy, see that in conjunction with the fiscal stimulus, just bear in mind the total picture. Also, another stimulating factor.
Can I ask you to speed up because I realize we still have a lot of things to
cover. Okay, I'll speed up. Effective exchange rate of rand, we see the rand is depreciated. It's normally effective exchange rate is an important one. Also, really, the real exchange rate is 26% down from its peak. Although it's been blunted by the drop-off in global trade, that leverage also helps us. Now, these are the projections, the macroeconomic projections from the budget. The February numbers now compared to October last year. Let's just look at the top line there, the GDP line, where you can see the reduction in growth forecast. And I just want to make one comment, and it looks very similar to our own forecast. So I don't have a big problem with those forecasts. Okay, we don't forecast it 2011, that 4% might be a bit high. But the 1.2% for this year, 3% for next year, it's not aligned in any big way with what we think ourselves. One thing that did raise my eyebrows a little bit regarding the projections is that household consumption expenditure is forecast in the budget to decline this year, minus 0.2%. Now that, to my mind, is a very pessimistic number. we're looking there for more than 1% still, but then we see less of a support still from net exports than what the budget documentation sees. So the revenue projections have been scaled back, and we're going to go into that, we know about that. And so we need some fiscal stimulus. Now, the IMF, late last year, 29 December, put out a document, Fiscal Policy for the Crisis, in which they give some ideas as to what countries should do and should not do. And they say the use of fiscal stimulus in this situation is increase investment spending. That's what we've done, we have been doing. Have targeted transfer payments, and that's also what we're doing in terms of increasing the social grants, for example. A temporary reduction in consumption taxes. We've avoided that, and I think we did well by avoiding that one. That would imply a reduction in the VAT rate. You saw the UK, for example, they did that late last year. They got a lot of criticism inter alia from out of Europe, saying that if you reduce the VAT rate, in an environment where businesses are under pressure, they might just keep prices unchanged and absorb that saving in their profits. They have no guarantee that it would be passed on to consumers in terms of lower prices. So avoid that. We avoided it. Lump sum targeted tax rebates, we didn't do that. We reduced income tax on individuals. And Chair, I must say that's the one point where I am a little bit critical of the budget. I personally would not have done it. In the past couple of years, we had a lot of tax relief for individuals, but that was financed out of revenue that was above what the estimates were. This time around, we're going to go and borrow money from the capital market. In other words, we're going to take money out of long-term savings and we're going to use it to give, on a permanent basis, tax relief to individuals. I would not personally have done it. I don't think it was quite necessary. Only compensation for bracket fees, I think, would be enough as far as I'm concerned. And then in other countries, you can reduce your unemployment fund contributions, but in our case, it's so small in any case. What should you avoid? Last year, new entitlement programs. We didn't do that. You should avoid an increase in your public sector wage bill. Now we have a bit of that because of last year's very healthy wage increases. On this point, there's some talk about increasing the size of the civil service, supporting additional teachers and policemen and so on. And I think there the budget review is quite spot on in saying that then we have to restrain wage increases. If you want to increase the body count, you have to decrease the wage increases. Increase subsidies for specific industries. We've avoided that basically. There's one or two small things for specific reasons, but it's not important. We avoided the reduction in corporate tax rates, dividends, and capital gains tax, which is fine. No amnesties or exemptions for troubled companies. No tax distortions to increase tariffs, for example. No schemes to try and bolster financial markets and prices by, for example, government buying assets and those kind of things. So, on that basis, what we did was fairly, I think, fairly sound. So, we're looking at deficits, and Ms. Mira also showed the same picture, so I'm not going to dwell on that. There are deficits going into the next few years. And this is just to put us into perspective, just to put this table up again. Our expected growth rate 1.2%, which is higher than most of the other countries that listed there. It's very difficult in our case actually to calculate the fiscal stimulus because it's part of your normal budgeting process. Whereas in the other countries have made announcements outside of their normal budget cycle, so it's easy to say, okay, this is additional. In our case, now, what is actually the stimulus package? Now, what I opted to do is to say government expenditure at percentage of GDP this year compared to last year will increase by just more than 2%, 2.2%. And the tax relief that we granted, you add that, you get to 2.6% of GDP. So we have a fair-sized fiscal stimulus relative to what our growth outlook still is for this year. And we must bear in mind that the combined stimulus, as I said, from the fiscal policy, reduction in interest rates, and also a weaker currency. Last point I want to make, Chair, about the sustainability. There's three strains, I think, showing up in the numbers. So one is the primary balance turning negative. Primary balance, in other words, if you take expenditure excluding the cost of servicing the government debt and subtract that from revenue. Government savings turning negative. And then the fairly hefty increase in government expenditure to GDP ratio. Now, all three, the budget indicates very temporarily that in 3 years' time we'll be sort of back to normal. On the expenditure side, it shows that there could be some small reduction in this ratio, but we're not going back to where we were previously. So that shows you the primary balance. The green column is there, we're going to deficit, whereas in total last year we thought we would remain positive. Consequence of that is that the debt increases. Still, as the graph shows you, compared to where we came from, let's say 10 years ago, still not to extraordinary levels, but we have to bring the primary balance back to zero, otherwise the debt as the GDP ratio is going to continue to rise. That is a must. Fact is also, I think, we must add to the government debt the guarantees that government's now supplying. Just the guarantee that was announced for ESCOM amounts to about 7% of GDP. So 27% debt ratio, that shown in the graph, but if you add that 7, that's already 34. That's a contingent liability that government has taken on. So that needs to be rectified, otherwise the state debt costs are also going to increase. As a percent continuing increase instead of stabilizing, and the cost of servicing that debt in terms of the bond yields that government will have to offer the market is going to increase. As you can see, there's a strong relationship to the size of the debt and that rate. The government savings that, as I said, will go into negative territory in spite of the current account balance, and we have to get that back to normal again. And then the increase in the government expenditure to GDP ratio to 33.7% this year and only coming back marginally. And as a result of that, of course, then also the tax to GDP ratio that's also increasing. And I just have to remind you, this is a quote from the growth report from last year, the Commission on Growth and Development, that government, as they put it, is not the proximate cause of growth, that growth is to the private sector, to investment and entrepreneurship, responding to price signals and market forces. And as it goes on, I'm not going to read the full quote, but just want to make the point that we're extending the size of government relative to the size of the economy to quite a high level compared to similar countries. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. Questions? I would appeal to members to be direct. Because you are running behind our schedule. Mr. Mguni, Dr. George, Mr. Marais.
Thanks, sir. That's two short questions. On the overall assessment, the second bullet, you're saying that there are trains that are starting to show. What are those trains? If you can just get up with some more trains. And what can be done? My second question here is on the bailout. Do you think South Africa should have, do you think Treasury should have budgeted for bailouts for those companies that you might go under if the recession really continues?
Dr. George?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the very interesting presentation. You mentioned that manufacturing production is collapsing. At the moment, many manufacturers are making use of contract workforces as and when the contracts arrive. Do you foresee an impact on manufacturers if they are required to maintain a permanent workforce rather than a contract workforce? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Doctor, I would like to just get your comment on the expected revenue. With that 50 billion rand that they less than what they projected last year, whether that will materialize as much as that. Then secondly, the 3.8% deficit, whether that is sustainable, taking into account if the world economy doesn't improve substantially. And so in other words, for how long can we sustain a huge deficit like that? And thirdly, I'm trying to try to compare our economy, the performance of our economy, and I'm not quite sure with whom we need to compare ourselves, because we're doing worse in Brazil, obviously worse than India and China, and we are not a first world economy. So, you know, how and where should we, and with whom should we compare ourselves to at least try to ascertain whether we're doing well or not? Thanks.
Okay, Chair, the strange, if I've not explained myself well enough, perhaps I put in a hurry, but I can just say the important point about the primary balance, as I said, we're going into a negative primary balance, and that by definition, if you do the sums, I don't want to bore you with all the technical details, that implies rising government debt, as we've seen in what was announced in the budget. My point is, if we don't return to a zero balance, at least on the primary balance, it means that government debt as a percentage of GDP is going to continue increasing. And the debt costs will therefore, as a percentage of GDP, will also continue increasing. And then that will mean you will have less money available to spend on other things. That's the one constraint, in government savings. Government savings are negative. It means you already have a savings shortage in South Africa, that we can't finance our investment spending ourselves. We're dependent on foreign capital. So if government goes into negative savings, it means it uses more of the savings that's available locally for its own expenditure, less being available, therefore, to the rest of the economy, and increasing our dependence, therefore, on other sources, on outside sources of capital. And last one, just on the government expenditure to GDP ratio. It's coming about now because of very specific circumstances. I'm not arguing that it shouldn't happen this year. All that I'm saying is that I think we should aim in future to return it to a more normal level. If you look at the growth history, compare it to a range of countries, I'll come back to that question of Maria just now. You will see that if you look at successful Asian economies, for example, their government expenditure to GDP ratios are much lower than ours. And the size of government, generally speaking, is a constraint on growth. Generally, you'll find countries where the ratio is higher have lower growth rates. Then your question about the bailouts. I personally don't believe in bailouts. I think it's companies that's taken wrong business decisions should bear the responsibility for them. It just struck me at the moment, for example, the motor industry is one that's very much highlighted. Let me say in our case, the motor industry is foreign companies that's operating here. A very large component of their activities is also in the form of imports. So I think if you want to support in the industry, the amount of money you would need to support the motor industry, I probably think can have a larger effect on the economy by perhaps doing something else. But specifically, as I said, companies that made mistakes, they should bear the responsibility. In the motor retail industry, for example, when things are going quite badly at the moment, I on the plane last week, Thursday, I sat next to a manager, a motor retailer. He has 19 outlets. And he said to me, but they overexpanded because in the good years they believe we are permanently moving into a 700,000 vehicles or cars per year market. And where he put it, they built palaces to sell cars, which is becoming a commodity. So, in other words, it's a discipline also. The conditions that we're under at the moment is a good discipline in some sense for the private sector to take out some of the nonsense that's taken place. So I'm not in favor of bailouts in general. The manufacturing sector, the contract workers versus permanent workforce, naturally, if there's a reduction in activity, the contract workers are the first to go. It's unfortunate, but that's the way the world works. Whether companies would be more constrained if they at permanent workforces, of course it would be a constraint. The process of and the cost of laying off permanent workers compared to contract workers are higher. I don't want to get into the whole debate now of the contract versus permanent workers, because there's many other aspects to it than just apart from, you know, manufacturers have to manage their wages. There are other aspects also which shows that there's more merit if you have a bigger permanent workforce for the economy as a whole, rather than contract workers. As far as Mr. Mahesh's few questions are concerned on the expected revenue, the 50 billion, to me that was quite a big cut. That's a hefty deduction. I must admit that the Treasury, they have a lot of information available to themselves in forecasting revenue that we, as private sector forecasters, don't have. So, my gut feel would be to say that I think they've been conservative. That is a little bit of protection in there. Second one, the sustainability of the 3.8% deficit if the world economy was not improved. Certainly, yes, if the world economy, the recession continues into next year, we don't get that bit of a bounce back that I showed you that the IMF, for example, is forecasting, then similarly, it would be difficult for us to have that bounce back, and then our revenue is going to be under more pressure for longer, and then we might end up with a bit of a higher deficit. That's certainly possible. And then lastly, a question about comparing with whom. I think we should choose, perhaps, who do we want to compare ourselves with, who do we regard as our peer group, who do we regard as possible role models for us to copy. I don't think we should compare ourselves to the first world, the advanced developed economies. I think that's wrong. Very often it's done just because the data is available more easily. And I don't think that's the way to do it, and we're much too harsh on ourselves. But what I personally do, I compare ourselves to Latin America, Brazil, Chile, Mexico, not Argentina and Venezuela and countries like that. In Asia, I compare ourselves to countries such as Thailand and Malaysia and India. Even if India is much larger than South Africa, there's a lot of similarities between their economy and the problems that they're struggling with and our problems.
Thank you so much, Mr. Lokshar, for always appearing before us to give us your perspective on the budget. We really welcome that support. Honourable members, you are going to have a tea break, 7 minutes tea break, and then we proceed with the next part of our session. Members, before us we have Professor Osman Molaji, Director of Technical and Training, PwC, who will be our first presenter, and that will be followed by Mr. Cian Kloon, the Chief Executive Officer of South African Institute of Tax Practitioners. Prof, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. Of course, thank you for the opportunity for us to present you our opinion or our initial assessment of the tax proposals coming out of last year's budget speech. And just before I continue, I am an accountant, so it wouldn't be proper for me to come up with a whole lot of disclaimers and wherefores and so on and so forth. So a couple of points that I would just like to make up front. Of course, only 2 or 3 days apart from that, had a chance and the various groupings we associated with have had to consider these the new proposals. So of course, we're not entirely sure that everything would have been covered, but we've done our best within the short time period. Of course, the other thing is, with taxes, most of us have known here, is that the devil's in the detail. The legislation will come out sometime in May, we suppose, it's only then, really, that we'll have a full appreciation of what's before us. And of course, given that this is just a very short forum, we're hoping to hit only the highlights or some of them. So, with that in mind, the two main headings, I suppose, that I'd like to cover is, first of all, just some of the specifics coming out of the tax proposal, and then just a couple of points, broad overviewish points about the health of our tax system, if you will, in relation to stimulating economic growth. First of all, a little bit of an initial assessment of the major proposals or the tax proposals. And I think our first point has got to be that it is welcomed generally within the tax practitioner community and certainly among taxpayers as well, that 2009 seems to be a year of very little happening as far as major amendments are concerned. We come now off the back over the past eight or nine years, around 1,600 pages of legislation that we've seen, new legislation coming through, amendments coming through over the past years. Members of this chamber will know some of the heated debates that have happened here. And it is welcomed, and I must say this is probably our biggest point, out of everything that I'm about to say, this is probably our biggest point, that taxpayers can take a breather. Instead of constantly focusing on what has changed this year, we now have a chance to really understand what happened last year and the year before. That's really what's been happening for the past few years. We haven't really had a chance to address last year's amendment and the impact and the fallout from that because we're too busy learning about the new rules as they come at us. That said, one of the reasons that has been given for the fact that we're not seeing major changes this year is because it's an election year, there's a shortened parliamentary program and so forth. But I do want to make the point right here that we do distinguish, or we should distinguish, between new major groundbreaking changes on the one hand, and on the other hand, fixing and tweaking what's gone before. Now, to say that we don't really want to do too much this year, I think that's sufficient. It's okay to say, look, okay, we won't have any major changes yet, but that doesn't mean that we should not take this opportunity to fix the unintended impact of what's happened in the past and technical amendments and things like that. So I don't think we should shy away from really looking at the fact, the provisions of the tax system as it stands now and try and fix it. Instead of just saying, look, we've got a shortened parliamentary period, let's just do as little as possible. I hope that point's relatively clear, but I'll take some questions again. Then coming to just some of the specifics, some of the issues that were addressed or were not addressed, or we hope would be addressed. The point about the second provisional tax return, it's an administrative issue, it's an estimate issue, but it continues to leave a bad taste in the mouths of many taxpayers. Submissions on this point have been ongoing for a long time and there has been no movement. I think it's a disappointment to many taxpayers that absolutely nothing was said about this. Staying with the administration, another thing that's come up, raised a few eyebrows as well, is the proposal to start charging compound interest on the late payment of tax generally. Now, the charging of interest has always been there for late payments, it's been simple interest. And taxpayers have always felt slightly aggrieved or slightly penalized, doubly penalized. Number one, that you have to pay interest, but I suppose that's not a penalty, that's normal. But the fact that penalties are not tax deductible. So now, in that context, to now add a further layer and say, hold on, interest from now on will be compounded as well and will remain, continue to remain non-tax deductible is something that has already shown up as something that taxpayers are wanting to take issue with. Another, I suppose, absence point in the budget proposals this year is the further development or further clarity on the implementation of the new dividend tax. A lot of detail has come through in the past, but a lot of questions have been asked, a lot of unanswered questions continue to remain unanswered. And I don't think I have too much of an issue with the fact that it didn't appear in the main budget documentation. I think the feedback that we're getting is certainly that we just want to make sure that in the detail that comes out later in the year, that it is addressed, that it does remain on the radar screen, the door is not entirely closed. But the fact that absolutely nothing's being said is cause for concern. And a similar point, surprisingly coming through, is the vast question of place of supply rules. In other words, if you are an entity that renders services or buys services or goods cross-border, some definition, some clarity on how the VAT rules apply when we trade cross borders, like that, the place of supply rules. I won't get into the technical detail, but it's the absence of any comments on this or any discussion about this that is worrying. It's a sore point that's been carrying on for a while. And to close off with, I wanted to talk about the South African tax system as a whole, and I do want to make a couple of important points. The point number one is just the system that we have, if we look at the legislation, if we look at the implementation, I don't think anyone can argue that this is a sophisticated system that is, Maria was asking earlier about who should we be benchmarking against. And as far as the tax system is concerned, we're up there. We're not talking about Argentina or Chile or Mexico. We're talking about the United States, Australia, the UK, some of the provisions, some of the provisions that we have in our income tax and the Income Tax Act as a whole. Is really on par with the best. Well, I don't know if I should say the best, the most sophisticated in the world. There's no doubt about it. And I do want to use this opportunity to commend National Treasury on the road that we've walked over the last decade and a half or so. From an economic growth perspective, of course, our economists earlier on were talking about funding in investments and the fact that we have this savings culture and it's difficult to fund investments internally. And there we talk about the compatibility with our tax system to foreign jurisdictions. And even though I just said we have a very sophisticated tax system, one of the biggest drawbacks, and again, this has been highlighted for several years now, is my second point here, the issue about the deductibility of interest on share acquisitions. And I can just make the point without getting into the technical detail. If you in South Africa borrow money to buy a business, so you buy a building and you buy machines and all of those kind of things, you can take the interest as a tax deduction because you bought a business. But if you buy that same business in a company, in other words, you don't buy the actual machines and buildings, you buy the shares, you have no interest deduction. And now that inability to deduct interest is a huge obstacle from an international investment perspective. And while it may be on the agenda, I think the point is that it's not vocally on the agenda, that no one knows whether this is likely to see the light of day is some cause for concern. So that I think submissions on this will continue to be made. They've been made in the past, and it remains or something that we want to get to the top of the agenda. So on the South African tax system, of course, the importance of an efficient administration system, again, is an important point for us, and just one of the hallmarks of a good tax system. And I think here, we probably have a lot more to applaud than we have to criticize in terms of where South Africa stands at the moment. If we look at the e-filing system that was rolled out, it's been going back several years now, the bulk of it in 2008. There were a lot of problems, but I don't think the good points that came out of the successes were applauded loud enough, and I do want to use this opportunity to say that I think we're doing really well. The problems, though they remain, are actually less than the successes that we've had. But again, it's something that requires attention. Again, feedback coming back this year, there's a proposal to have a very short filing date for 2009, only 5 months long, and taxpayers are asking, are we now being held to ransom because of SARS's need to have a super efficient internal system? So it's all great that SARS is going to have a very fast turnaround time and they can do things quickly, but are we expecting the entire country to file within 5 months? Well, the work from the taxpayer side can't be squeezed into 5 months. We have 5 months of this, you know, panic and 7 months of doing nothing. SARS might sustain it, but the entire taxpayer base might not be able to, certainly tax practitioners as well. The point about provisional tax and the change of from SBC to the dividend tax that I mentioned before. And just as a final point, it's not really a tax matter, but we have heard from our economists a lot about where are we going on exchange control. And I think the response or the comment coming from business on exchange control is simply a question of say something. I for example, might have said, given the current economic climate, now might have been the best time to have a further relaxation of exchange control because investors by themselves are so nervous, we're not going to see a huge cash outflow, so maybe now is a good time. But that's one opinion. The problem, of course, is that there's no comment coming out, there's no direction or no indication of what the direction is. So just some kind of discussion about that is something that we would have asked for. Thank you very much.
Can we move to the next presenter, and then we'll take questions then.
Good morning, everyone. Mr. Chin, thank you very much for the opportunity to present our comments on the 2009 budget speech delivered by Mr. Manuel last week. Firstly, we'd like to congratulate the Minister for a pragmatic and well-balanced budget that will instill confidence in the face of the current economic challenges facing our country and the wider global community. Mr. Chair, please allow me to just give some brief background on general comments that we've got on the government expenditure and revenue. On the expenditure side, while we welcome the budget overall, and especially the additional 18% expenditure on infrastructure, there are a few major items that government need to take account of. And as Professor Malagi indicated, we've got time this year to reflect that came through in previous years and also our budget expenditure. The overall efficiency in government spending is very poor when we look at expenditure outcomes. Furthermore, the delivery of government programs is sometimes questionable. Just to list a few, Mr. Chair, one or two examples on why we say this. On the expenditure on education expenditure as a percentage of GDP is well above the world average and has remained this way for quite a number of years. This is the biggest single expenditure item on the South African budget. The problem, Mr. Chair, is not the amount of money we spend, but the outcomes of our education system. In all international tests of South African learners, such as the progress in international reading literacy study and the trends in international mathematics and science study, South African learners comes last. African countries who spend much less than South Africa, such as Botswana and Ghana, come ahead of South African learners. Moreover, when comparing the result of high school finishes across 19 emerging market economies, South Africa comes second last. When comparing the entry into tertiary education, South Africa comes last among all emerging and developing countries. This happens despite South Africa spending well over the average on education, and I will just refer to some stats on that. Out of 40 countries that took part of the latest study in reading and literature, South Africa comes last. This while the average age of South African students was 1.9 years older than the average age of international students that took part in the study. To put this into perspective, let's have a look at chart 1 to 3 on the slides, and I've attached it as an extra A to our submission. If one looks at the world average, the spending on education as a percentage of GDP, you will see that South Africa spends roughly about 5.4%, and the world average, as I indicated to you earlier, 4.7%. Now, the list of countries that I've included in, on that graph is emerging countries. Like I indicated earlier, we are not a first world country, we're not a first world economy, so it is appropriate for us to compare to those emerging countries. I think in your own time you can have a look at compare to the different graphs and see the percentage of the percentage of spending on education as a percentage of GDP compared to the outcomes and the amount of skilled labour we've got in South Africa. On the poll test I referred to earlier, in 2006 the selected countries that I referred to, the poll's average is about in the region of 500. Now, the poll's average referred to developing countries as well as first world countries. Okay. Now, on the graph, I only indicated the emerging markets, how South Africa compared to the emerging markets. So you will see there again, unfortunately, we lost on that graph. Okay? If you move on to graph chart 3, the university exemption ratios are selected emerging markets again. The WEI mean stands for, let me refresh my mind on that one, I've got, it's a world education indicator for emerging markets. That is the mean there, and again, South Africa came roughly below 10% on that. If you, let's move on. So this leads to the fact that the African labour force is poorly educated, those facts, when compared to other emerging markets. South Africa has less than a third of the tertiary educated workforce than the emerging market average. Now, if you have a look on the slides, you will see, and I'll just have to explain some background on the slides. In terms of South Africa is the blue one, the WEI mean is the orange kind of colour, reddish, and then the green one is the OECD countries. Now, some of the members of this committee will know that we are planning to become a member of the OECD. Now, there's currently 30 members, there's 30 members of the OECD, and we are planning to become a member. Now, that is why it's appropriate to measure us and us against that benchmark. Now, if we want to have a look at no schooling, if you compare that to the OECD, it's 0%. If you WEI mean, it's 3.6 people out of 100 have no schooling. And Africa, it's nearly 6 out of 100 people are uneducated. If we just go on, I would like to move on to the university, because that is ultimately why we also spend on education, to see that our learners become tertiary educated, because they will be the job providers in future. Now, tertiary type A, in terms of African equivalent, that will be a person with a university degree. And you will see, if you look at the OECD, 18 out of 100 people in the OECD countries on average have a tertiary degree. The average is roughly 9 individuals, and this is Africa coming last again, 3.0, 3 people out of 100. The tertiary education. Tertiary type B, that is in our equivalent, it's university of technologies, colleges, those kind of type of tertiary education. Again, South Africa coming in at 5.2, again the lowest. Upper secondary is up to grade 10. Again, South Africa coming last at 22.7, roughly 23 people out of 100 have only upper secondary level, whereas in the OECD countries you've got 45 individuals, and so it goes on. While developing countries generally have few people working as a percentage of the population, it's becoming clear that Africa is at the lower end of the spectrum. This leads to a high tax burden of the working population. And when one takes into account the overall taxes as a ratio of the population employed, one can say the economically active South Africans have one of the highest burdens in the world. Now, if I just can jump to the last slide, you can see the tax burden as a rate, the rate of tax revenue to GDP. You can see that South Africa's got where we feature with other countries internationally. So we've got, if you take excluding local and provincial taxes, we've got 28.4%. Okay. This chair, please allow me to move on to the health expenditure. The basic delivery of health care is also not delivering as much as it should. According to statistics of the World Health Organization, Kenya, for example, has doubled the number of health care workers as a percentage of the population as South Africa. These statistics are aggravated by the fact that Kenya only spends two-thirds as much on health care as South Africa. Much the same applies when looking at some other African countries. If one look at, for example, Mauritius and Swaziland, they get more efficiency in government spending compared to healthcare workers as a percentage of their population. While being one of the biggest spenders on health, the South African life expectancy has dropped to only 44 years according to the World Health Organization. Now, Mr. Chair, certainly HIV and AIDS are playing a large role here, but our government health spend is higher than almost all African countries. In relative GDP terms, Africa is certainly also not a laggard in emerging market country terms. Again, the message is clear that Africans do not get as good delivery on healthcare as many other African and other emerging market countries. But African taxes as a percentage of GDP are fairly high for emerging market countries, and it is clear that one of the main ways to address this problem is that delivery of government services will have to improve. On the revenue side, in the medium-term budget policy statement in 1997, there was a statement that total tax to GDP will not go over 25%. This was repeated a few times in other budgets. However, the total tax rate in Africa is still expected to be over 25% of GDP. If local government taxes are included, this is even aggravated. This has been the case since the 2002-2003 budget, and it is budgeted to be the case until 2011-2012. Therefore, a full 10 years outside the 25% barrier. The further contributing factor is electricity and water rates, as this can be used as a form of tax, as the rates are used to subsidize poor households. This will bring the effective tax to GDP ratio rather close to 30%. On the tax burden, coming back to that, currently 25% of individual taxpayers pay 75% of all personal income tax. This is massive in anybody's terms and needs. Only 0.25% of companies in South Africa pay 55% of corporate taxes, while less than 5% of all companies pay 91% of all taxes, company tax apologies. This is a huge burden by any standard and needs to be addressed in the future. Mr. Chair, I'll move on to specific comments on the recent budget. On the small business corporation side, we would like to comment as follows. As a key area in the economy and the sector that makes the greatest proportional contribution to job creation, it is disappointing to us that a budget continued virtually no additional tax relief for small businesses. Tax incentives for small businesses, apart from the new turnover tax regime for micro businesses, are essentially contained in the special tax tables and tax allowances applicable to small business corporations. The practical problem with this package is that the scope of the definition of a small business corporation is very narrow. As a starting point, it only grants relief to incorporated businesses, which automatically excludes sole traders and partnerships. This creates a situation where incorporated businesses are favored over the unincorporated businesses and counterparts, which is undesirable and can also be seen to be unconstitutional. We suggest that equal tax relief should be granted to all forms of small business enterprises. Furthermore, the scope of the definition of a small business corporation is limited in that the shareholders of companies and closed corporations, which must be all individuals, are prohibited from holding any other shares apart from certain permitted investments, such as shares in listed companies, interest in body corporates, sectional title companies and cooperatives. The rationale for this limitation is that the relief is intended for small, simple companies. There are, however, many legitimate small companies, one or more of whose shareholders have an interest in a dormant property holding company, in spite of the fact that a property holding company will never trade. The mere fact that an individual has an interest in a property company and also in a separate trading company prevents that trading company from accessing the small business corporation concessions. The amendments proposed in the 2009 budget goes a small way towards correcting this anomaly in providing that interest of a shareholder in a shell company will not preclude the trading company from being classified as a small business corporation. However, the commentary states that this relief will only apply if the company has never been more than a shell. We suggest that the integrity of the small business corporation relief would not be compromised if shareholders were also permitted to hold shares in dormant property holding companies. And lastly, another aspect that should be addressed in the definition of this of a small business corporation is the complexity that arises where the shareholder is married in community of property. As in those circumstances, the restrictions that have been outlined above extend to any interest of held by the spouse of the shareholder. Mr. Chair, I'll move on to the VAT registration. We welcome this increase in the VAT registration threshold from 1 million rand from 1 March 2009, as this will enable very small businesses to deregister as vendors, thereby saving related VAT compliance costs. We are, however, concerned about a problem that many small businesses encounter in trying to register as VAT vendors, either because they have to register to comply with the VAT legislation or where they need to register for valid business reasons. While we understand the need for SARS to manage their risks related to VAT refunds, we suggest that their risk lies not so much in the registration of vendors, but rather in the actual payout of the refunds. As it is compulsory for persons to register as vendors in certain circumstances, the process of meeting this legal obligation should be made reasonably easy. In this regard, we suggest that there should be additional verification measures introduced, but there should not be additional verification measures put in place, as such as was suggested last year, the fingerprints, when a person is attempting to apply to becoming a VAT vendor. Furthermore, the need for the proposed amendments to increase the minimum turnover required for voluntary registrations from the 20,000 rand to 50,000 rand is questioned. Small startup businesses that require a VAT registration number in order to secure business, such as government contracts, should be allowed to obtain this registration. This approach will assist businesses with getting on with business by removing unnecessary administrative obstacles. Mr. Chair, I move on to the proposals on the excise duty and alcoholic beverages. Sin taxes on various products are routinely increased annually. For example, the duty on malt beer was increased this year to 7 cents per can. We note, however, that the duty on the traditional beer and traditional beer powder has not been increased for more than 5 years. It would be useful for the difference of this treatment to be explained. Moving on to tax submission deadlines, Mr. Chair, it was noted in the budget speech that the deadline for submission of the 2009 individual tax returns is 18 September 2009 for manual filers and for electronic filing 20 November 2009. By way of comparison, Mr. Chair, the deadline for submission of the 2008 tax returns were 5 December 2008 for manual filers and for electronic filing 5 February 2009. Although it should be noted that these dates were later due to a change in the system for the submission of employees' reconciliations. While a deadline of some 69 months, Mr. Chair, may seem reasonable, the ability of practitioners to meet these deadlines depends on a number of factors that are beyond their control, such as the issuing of the forms by SARS and the effective operations of the SARS call centre and the e-filing system. To The date on which the tax returns are issued by SARS is critical to the overall success of the filing season program. Logically, the earlier returns are issued, the more time practitioners have to get through their workload, with the result that the chance of all returns being submitted on time is increased. The final deadline date is therefore intrinsically connected to the date the tax returns are issued by SARS, and therefore both of these dates should be specifically stated up front as part of the filing season program. We suggest that the date for issue of the tax returns should be no more than 14 to 28 days after the deadline for submission of employers. Delaying this date puts undue pressure on practitioners, as unable to proceed with the preparation of the tax returns until the forms are issued by SARS. If the date of the issue is delayed by SARS, the final submission date should be extended accordingly. Last but not least, in the light of the current global economic situation, increase in interest and taxable dividend exemption. The increase in the interest and taxable dividend exemption is not sufficient. It's welcome, but it's not sufficient. The Reserve Bank has announced the level of saving by households in the 2006-2007 year was negative, and in light of the current global economic climate, it expected to have deteriorated even further. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Dr. George, Mr. Nguni, Mr. Marelli.
Thank you, Chair. Professor Mology, there has been much commentary on the complexity of our tax system. Do you think the time is right now for a review of our tax system with a view to simplification? Thank you, Mr. Clue. You mentioned it's the high tax burden carried by a few taxpayers and the lack of value for money in expenditure. What can government do to improve the value proposition for the taxpayer? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you to Professor Mlaki. He says that this minute I should have said talk about the exchange from top to the east, and yet you are in this trouble today, so you shall let that because of the exchange from top. Now, what do you foresee, or what would you advocate for more exchange of soul abolition? As the lady over there earlier on said, no, she's been advocating that people must not get their notes. They must not be removed. On the other hand, I think they must be removed. And we've seen that the banks are failing because of the poor prevention and regulations in the question. And to Mr. Q, one of the same question is that the short that he says only 20% of the population has been affected, over 25% of the income. But as a CEO, you cannot expect me to pay attention to you. You're earning $1 million, I mean less than half of the salary, and expect me to pay the same amount as you. Many of the Africans are earning below, because yeah, you expect the school to pay less than they are. That's why actually I think that we are paying 25%, 45% of the population is paying 25% because of the amount of the, according to the U.S. salary scale. So what you think is that would you propose a reasonable rate? As you can see, in your slide there are countries that Denmark is having more than 20% of it. So I think that's a good rate. What you think is a reasonable rate? And this is for you.
Before I move to Mr. Mave, I had a complaint earlier that the sound system is not quite good. I just want to check whether people in the gallery can hear members as they speak. Okay, no, that's fine. Mr. Mare?
Thank you, sir. To the professor, just on corporate tax, you've said that no major changes, it's welcome. We are seeing reduced profits, we're seeing thousands of people being laid off by businesses. Are you happy with the current interest rates or tax rates for corporates, and that it will not be detrimental to employment further employment and economic growth, and specific concessions to maybe SMEs. And then secondly, we want to stimulate employment, specifically within SMEs. Do you have any ideas in terms of how incentives via the tax system can be utilized or be in support of that? And then to Mr. Clue, just on the so-called sin taxes, I think to a large extent, you know, there's a very much a kind of a laissez-faire approach by everybody about the sin taxes, except those who are affected by that, and that is specifically the agricultural industry, tobacco maybe, and then specifically in the wine industry, or the liquor industry, if I can call it that. They are complaining that the proportion of the end product that goes as taxes to government is basically defeating the object, and they are getting smaller. Have you got any view on that, specifically with regard to whether that is in support of growing that part of the industry, especially compared, you know, if you look at that in relation to GDP and what has happened over the last couple of years? Thank you, sir.
Just one question to Mr. Fu. On the issue of the tax burden, you're saying currently 25% of individuals pay 25% of all personal income tax, and you give us a fee for company tax. My first question is, would the appropriate argument not be we should be attending to the structure of the South African economy? Because if you say few companies are paying tax, I would say that's a function of the structure of the South African economy. So the second issue on tax burden on 25% of the individual, also that would be, for me, the reflection of the level of employment in the economy. So what do you suggest should be done about that? Because you are saying it's a matter that should be addressed sooner, as if we have to reduce the tax burden. And for me, the argument would be if you address the issue of the structure of the economy of South Africa and let more people work, then that would end up addressing your concern. But as you present it now, it's as if we have to reduce the tax rate in order to address the issue of the tax burden. I'm not sure whether I'm understanding you correctly. Yeah, over to the presenters. I think that those are the questions.
Okay, thank you. First of all, Dr. George, on the issue of the complexity and sophistication of the South African tax system and the case for a review or simplification, certainly one of the announcements made in this year's budget proposals was for a rewrite of the Income Tax Act. And a couple of points I want to make. The first point I want to make is, even though I was applauding earlier on the sophistication of the South African income tax system, it's important for us to appreciate that just because we have a bunch of really, really clever people sitting up in Treasury doesn't mean that we have to demonstrate our skills in writing really, really sophisticated legislation just because we can and because we are able to believe it. The issue in this chamber has come up a lot today again on the point of who do we benchmark ourselves against. And I have often here asked the question, if we have an economy, well, maybe if I asked the question a year ago or 2 years ago, if we have an economy that is not comparable with the United Kingdom or the United States, why do we need a tax system that is as sophisticated in that and sometimes as harsh or even harsher than those regimes? But that aside, the simple answer to your question is yes. I do think there's it's time for a review. Now is a good time. Although it's not an easy process, in 2008 New Zealand completed the income tax, their income tax rewrite, a process that took them 11 years. It's a journey of 1,000 steps, so it needs to be started. In South Africa, we've got an income tax act that was last consolidated in 1962. Before that, it was last consolidated in 1955. It gets consolidated, or it used to get consolidated and simplified and rewritten relatively regularly. It hasn't happened for the past half a century. I think the time is now. And then moving on to the second question on international law. Sorry, I wasn't clear. I wasn't supporting the call for a relaxation. I was saying there are varying opinions out there. Maybe relaxation is appropriate. Ms. Muller earlier on certainly made a very strong case for why it shouldn't be. My point is really to say we have silence. Can we at least have some kind of direction from the Ministry of Finance, from Treasury, saying, this is where we stand, these are the considerations, and this is why we're doing this, or this is why we're doing nothing. But at the moment, we have no such comments. So I certainly wasn't saying that we should be advocating strongly that we should be relaxing exchange control. I certainly do respect the comments about it was in fact exchange control that protected us to a large degree from the financial crisis. Then the last two questions from Mr. Murray, I'd like to kind of deal with together because I must say I am not an advocate of the tax system in isolation, presenting rescue packages, presenting incentives, and or those kind of things. So, for example, the question that you asked about tax rates and whether they should be reduced as perhaps some kind of support to companies that might be struggling. There are all sorts of complications that I have with that suggestion. Earlier on, one of my economists made the point about the UK and the reduction of the VAT rate and the question of, well, if companies do have a lower tax cost, do they inevitably pass that on to consumers? I do understand the point about, well, if they've got a lower tax cost, then maybe it increases their chances of staying afloat. But I definitely am slightly more of a hardliner when it comes to that. Companies need to take responsibility, as Mr. Loach said early on, for their actions, and government really needs to step back to and not be too eager to save them, if you will. And a kind of related point was your last question on incentives. While I do think that Treasury, from a tax perspective, needs to have targeted incentives to promote investments, to encourage investments, I don't think any investor, I think there's very few investors, that come to a particular investment destination purely because of the tax rates or incentives. I think what has happened up until now, I'm a big supporter of what's happened in some of the incentives that came through in 2008, where Treasury, from a tax perspective, looked at what the Department of Trade and Industry was offering and made sure that if everything is in place, at least tax does not stand in the way, and if tax can be an additional sweetener, then so be it. But I don't think we can see tax as being the incentive driver for encouraging this kind of investment. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you, Chief. Yeah, a lot of the questions are that three questions is basically related, and if I can help stop with question one, what can government do to increase their value proposition? Now, with that goes, what do you propose to relieve the high tax burden? Question two, and then and the function of the high tax burden. Now, if I can combine those two, three questions and comment on it. Together, I think, first of all, like I pointed out, the return on investment, the bottom line, the return on investment is very poor compared to other emerging markets. So a lot of these high-end taxpayers have to pay for their own health, in addition to the tax that the high taxes they pay. They have to pay, in addition to that, for proper schooling for the children, because they don't want their children. If I go back to my slide, if you compare the university exemption ratios of selected emerging markets, if one do a full test on a public school a learner, these individuals pay, in addition to the high taxes they pay for them to go to private schools because they want to get proper education for their children. So I think what can the government do? I think, first of all, the fact that the minister mentioned it in the budget speech that it is a concern for government efficiency is already a good starting point. The fact is that there will be there will be more asked from government government departments to show where the efficiency is going to, wasteful costs, to reduce that. So I think that's the starting point, realizing. Secondly, I think governments need to have a bigger hand in making sure that the departments, the return on investment of the money that's allocated to them, are being properly spent. Okay. So if one takes into account the high tax burden versus the return on investment, that is the concern. Not the amount of taxes paid, but rather the return on investment. So that's the bottom line. On the third question, on the sin taxes, is detrimental. Depending on from which side you see it, ultimately that is passed on to the consumer. So that shouldn't have a huge impact on the operations of these companies. Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Ngun?
Just a follow-up question here on the benchmarking issue. There's a study that was done, I just forgot the writer here, in Africa, is that most African countries are unable to collect tax, or they end up having depending on donors for their government policies for their programs, because they are unable to collect tax. Now, if we sit down and say we compare ourselves to African countries, for that matter, and they are unable to collect tax, they are unable to put government projects into place at the moment, depending on funding. At the same time, we're taking that we must bring down our taxes and benchmark ourselves, say, within African countries, at least at the moment, we cannot. That's why you probably end up in much more sales like, you know, developed countries, because for the certain tax system, they are able to collect the taxes. My question is actually, do you think we should then relax our tax collecting system and end up in like any other African countries? Yes, if you don't collect taxes, then inevitably you won't be able to get any coming from the UK.
Any further questions for us? Okay.
Just
as
a
question.
I just want to check with the presenters, especially in relation to that issue that has been raised with regard to the investment that we are making onto education and health, because I would suppose that the commitment that the government has made is that they will deliver education and health, and that commitment has been outlined or can be seen through the investment that government has made. The allocations that it is prepared to spend with regard to the two areas, including other areas of public spending. I want to check, maybe like we have been receiving that criticism for some time as government not getting value for money. What are you suggesting that government should do? Because nobody did come clear as to what is it that government should prioritize in order to correct the situation. Here we are talking about the commitment to ensuring proper education, expanded reach to the people in terms of health and education. So I want to check what proposal are you bringing onto the table for government to correct the situation, because it does not help for us to get the criticism without any solution being put on the table. The second issue that I wanted to raise is the issue of the projection in terms of revenue growth. In the past year, some critics have mentioned that at times it seems that the government is overprojecting so that they are able to cover up for the loss that might happen. With regard to the current situation, obviously there is low revenue collected from the business sector, and then government is prepared to bring more risk to that, to also individuals, and that will have an impact. I want to check whether the current projection that the government has made really does make sense. Thank you, Mr. President.
Mr. Murray.
Thank you, sir. Maybe just again to the professor in terms of the questions that I've asked. Maybe it wasn't correctly understood what my objective was, and that is, was rather to look at the employment side and incentives to employment and whether corporate tax plays any role. I'll tell you why I'm asking. Is that there's a viewpoint that if you reduce corporate tax, and if you bring in an incentive for the employment of, for instance, first-timers, with, for instance, a wage subsidy as a tax credit, that you will broaden the tax base, that you will have more people inside there, so it will be in support of not only employment, but also broaden the tax base. And that was more my angle that I was coming from. I don't know if your view is still the same on what I've asked. And this, just in terms of the syntax, I think if one look at, see how many wine farms that has been in families for generations and generations and generations have now been sold to foreigners, so then maybe your stat is wrong.
Eric, before that, can I ask Prof to shed some bit of light? I know you don't drink like me. I don't drink. But what was the rationale for not equating the tax between malt beer and traditional beer? Would you have an answer on that? Okay, no, that's fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chief. I agree that that is one thing to criticise, but I think if one look at the fact that you came down to come and address this committee, it should not be seen as criticism. I think we need to take hands. I think it's easy to see if somebody reprimands you or point out your negative points. It's easy to perceive it as criticism. But I think the fact that you're here is not to criticize, but rather to say this is the hard fact and you need to address it. So I think overall, my suggestion would be is for us to become partners. I think it's easy in the past, but I think in future we need to have these kind of forums where we do get together and share our points of view. Government from the one side to say this is why we are not maybe delivering. Give us the reasons and let's discuss it. So first of all, I think as a suggestion, if one look at the Alan Joseph Hospital in Johannesburg, people are lying the dying. So there is no delivery. If one wants to go to that far side of the coin and the equation. So there is no delivery. So I think to increase the service delivery would be a starting point, because there's money put towards that by taxpayers. So, and then also to get rid of corruption. For teachers to arrive at school to at least teach, that's the starting point. What do people get paid for to at least arrive at 8 o'clock for school? And that brings me to accountability. I think there needs to be greater accountability. Okay. And if taxpayers see that they are getting at least to acceptable, not exceeding expectations, but rather acceptable service delivery, that in turn would increase the compliance culture of South Africa.
I think that's all. We're going to. Prof.
Okay, there are a couple of questions I think that might have been directed, and if I can just try and address them. First of all, from Mr. Ngumi, the question about the benchmarking, and I do want to make it clear that I don't think anyone is suggesting that we have a reduction in the tax rate or there should be any reduction in efficiency. And I do want to make the distinction, on the one hand, between the tax law that we have and the executive part of it, the actual role that SARS fulfills in efficiency. And as far as tax collection is concerned, I don't think we should be benchmarking against anyone. I think SARS should be striving to be the best of the best. Forget what the rest of the world's doing. But that is collection. As far as the sophistication of the legislation is concerned, we do sit in South Africa with a mixture of third and first world taxpayers, for lack of a better phrase. And I want to add to the point that's been debated here about the proportion of taxpayers contributing to the tax take. It is directly a function of the income levels, the access to services. Another statistic similar to the one that was already quoted, which comes out of the tax statistics publication by Treasury and SARS in December 2008, which I think is when it's included in the State Department as well. Another way of putting that was to say that over the 5-year period from 2003 to 2008, 6% of South Africans contributed to 46% of the tax collection. So the point there is simply to make it more accessible and understandable and simple. That is the point that I'm making. It's not about making reducing the tax take or reducing the tax collection. Tax professionals, tax practitioners, and sometimes less than 100 humans or less than 100 individuals in this country sometimes understand certain provisions. What's the point of that? I mean, the point really was accessibility and simplification. And then the final point was on the incentives and the relationship between corporate tax and employment and that discussion. And I do kind of stick to my guns on that point, that I think sufficient has been done. I do think, and if I can just use a couple of examples. For example, we have extra incentive allowance in the Tax Act already for learnership, not only encouraging companies to spend on educating, on training their employees, but also to spend on first-time employees. So there's a greater incentive for spending on new employees that are coming to the system for the first time. But I think those incentives are in point. There are a couple of others are, and I think they need to be supported. The question of whether they go far enough, I know that's a separate debate, but I do want to hang on to the point that in order for this incentive to be useful, you do need a groundswell of employable individuals. So there's little point in throwing more and more money at giving trade incentives, saying to companies, train your employees and employ new employees and train them well and spend loads of money on training them, and we will give you tax breaks for that. That is already there. As I said, the jury's out about whether it's sufficient. There's a lot of debate about whether we could do more. But in addition to that, there are some non-tax considerations that I'm not always qualified to talk about that do need to be factored in as well. And we need to have this comprehensive, all-inclusive approach. So I think your point is relevant, and we shouldn't take our eye off it. We shouldn't discount it entirely. We shouldn't discount it at all, but we shouldn't think that it by itself, in isolation, is the solution to everything.
That's it. We're going to break for lunch. We will convene later to take a presentation from civil society, that's Pedusa Abusa Data.